Transition, the podcast of the Cultural Studies Association, sponsored and published through the open source journal Lateral. Positions aims to provide critical reflection and examination on topics in cultural studies for scholars, students, and a general audience. Make sure to follow CSA and Lateral Journal on socials and subscribe to our podcast to keep up with new episodes. In this episode, we're joined by Drs. Ree Van Schenk and Elaine Venter, editors for Lateral Special Edition, Digital Platforms and Agency. The edition is a collection of author works focusing on the tensions between the encroachment of digital platforms on cultures by immensely powerful technology companies and the emergence of possibilities as people work, play, and express themselves on these platforms. We ask and answer through the works, what does human agency look like in an age where it seems we are controlled by platforms and their algorithms? Enjoy the discussion. Host Dolores Phillips. I am the director of the African, African American, and Diaspora Studies Center at James Madison University. I'm also associate professor of postcolonial literature and theory and vice president of the Cultural Studies Association.
My name is Ree Van Schenk. I've co-edited Digital Platforms and Agency. I'm an assistant professor of communication and media at IE University in Madrid. And I am also co-chair of the New Media and Digital Cultures Working Group of the Cultural Studies Association.
Hi, everyone. My name is Dr. Elaine Venter. I am one of the co-editors for the special edition. I am also a lecturer at Kennesaw State University at the School of Communication and Media and the soon-to-be director of Center of Sustainable Journalism.
So can you tell us the inspiration for this particular journal issue?
Yeah, flashback all the way to 2023, simpler times. In the New Media and Digital Cultures Working Group, we always like to bounce around different ideas for what we can do with the submissions that we receive for the annual conference. And an idea emerged within one of our sort of semesterly meetings that we should put together a special section on digital platforms and agency, since so many of the submissions that year were centered around these themes. And so the working group put its heads together. Elaine and I kind of stepped up to the plate in order to shepherd this thing to some sort of conclusion, neither of us having editorial experience. And we put together a call for papers on digital platforms and agency. From there, we sent it far and wide. And, you know, how many submissions did we end up getting?
I believe, Reid, that we got close to 70.
Yeah, that sounds about right. And, you know, from there, we had to narrow it down. We wanted the section to be short enough where many people could really actually read all the articles, but, you know, long enough to include as many different voices and points of view and platforms as possible. So I think we accepted somewhere around 12, 13 abstracts out of our received pool. And then from there, 8 managed to make it to publication, which is finally coming out just now if you're listening as this podcast is released.
I just also want to give a great shout out to Mark Nunes, who was our former chair for the New Media Digital Cultures Working Group, who really instituted this culture of, after a conference, what do we do next? I think that's so important. A lot of people are part of academic organizations where, you know, we pay money to be a part of these things. And the big question is, like, you go to a conference, maybe you get a paper presented, a paper already published, but what happens afterwards? And so there's this great support network that's been built to actually help. It's a great mentorship. There's a group mentorship program, and Mark really worked very hard to help develop projects after the fact, whether it's something that you needed to continue to a new conference or for something like this, looking at what we could develop into special editions. And I think that's something incredibly special that I just don't see at a lot of particular institutions. And I know it's difficult work because it's all volunteer work. So just a special shout out there. And I don't get any extra credit points because I'm not in any of his courses. So this, and so he's not even a chair or co-chair anymore. So there's not even brownie points at this point.
So can you tell us more about the process, about the author works that you solicited and received, about the way that the issue came about?
Yeah, I think when we arrived at this intersection of platforms and agency, I don't know about you, Elaine, but for me, agency was kind of the easy one because we saw a lot of similar areas in the cultural studies conference that year coalescing around these ideas of the human, non-human binary, virtual, actual, the role of human relationality in infrastructure, dealing with questions of identity that often get left out of the sort of hegemonic approach to platform studies. So for me, that inclusion was kind of the easy part. I think conceptualizing platforms was more difficult, which is not surprising coming from a bunch of pedantic media scholars that are going to argue about what a platform is. But, something that was clear to us is that we didn't want it to necessarily just be, Facebook, Instagram, social media platforms as Web 2.0 scholarship traditionally conceives of them. We wanted there to be space for infrastructures that go beyond, the sort of user interface social media platform. We wanted there to be space for the data economies. We wanted there to be space for platforms like Airbnb, for example, which features very prominently in one of our authors' works, and other platforms that we don't think of as being necessarily as expressive places where agency is most readily seen. So a lot of the initial work went into forming a call for papers, artificial intelligence as well, of course, although we didn't end up publishing an AI. We formed a call for papers that invited scholars who are interested in all these types of platforms to recognize that their work would have a space in this section.
Yeah, that was really interesting for me as well as someone who both works and teaches in social media, especially. It was so easy to see how social media had become a predominant focus of platforming, especially when we teach media in schools. We're teaching about content creation and development predominantly on your mainstream media. Anytime I teach my content creation course, there's always a matter of like, which apps, which platforms are going to make the cut this year? And it's always the ones that are, we looked at monetization. I didn't want that to be the only defining point of platforms. And Reed and I very much agreed on that concept because we also saw that at the 2023 conference with all the different kind of presentations. Also, from what we saw in mainstream media, what was being covered, Alexa and privacy security concerns over those kinds of uses of weaker AI, but also as a platform itself was becoming a search form itself was becoming very interesting. And so it was really looking at how do we complicate. I wouldn't necessarily say complicate, but how do we expand on the popularized definitions of platforms? And I really enjoyed looking at works from Alexander Galloway, which Reed was also very well versed in. And so we kind of brought that together. One thing that was also very important for us, which I love as a mission for what we do in cultural studies, is multidimensional and interdisciplinary learning and research. So it was super important for us that we didn't just get work from just cultural studies people. Yes, we wanted cultural studies work or cultural studies emphasized work or work that could expand cultural studies, but we really tried to open it to every like, you're a scientist in computer science. Heck yeah, we want your work. Bring it in. We could help you frame it in the way that we needed for cultural studies, but we wanted to see what other takes would be from this that maybe we were missing from our own perspectives. Because that was one of the challenges too, making sure that the work wasn't mired in our own biases, pedagogical and or personal, in order to create an ask that was really focused, but also open at the same time.
And that sounds like such a meaningful intervention because of the valuable shifting away from an expansion of authorship and inclusiveness, and also the way that the framing ends up expanding. Because it seems to be moving away from this kind of extractionist politics that characterizes the relationship between platforms and users, where users become a product, where users are commodified. It seems as if that's really a very limiting way to think about it. And it gets at my next question, where we're thinking about the question of agency. How did your edition frame agency? How did it frame expansions of agency? Can you talk about that a little bit?
I love the point you made about extractive politics because we were actually thinking about that when we were considering our ethos as editors in relation to this thing that we're describing as agency. If we are telling our authors, this is the argument you need to make about agency so that it fits our predetermined position in the constant cultural studies debate between structure, culture, and agency in order to make our own careers look a lot better, then where would the agency of our authors be? Where would their unique perspective be, right? I think the way that we thought about agency not only was like part of the practice of putting this special section together, really letting even the disagreements in between the articles shine, not presenting, one story that everybody's going to accept, pluriversal perspective on the relationship between platforms and agency, but also one that's rooted within the different perspectives that folks within cultural studies have taken towards the question of agency. Elaine, it was actually your idea to frame our approach towards the relationship between platforms and agency around Beth Coleman's notion of recess technology and the appropriation of the tools that are sort of afforded as, racialized people engage with platforms in kind of experimental ways as the starting point for our approach to agency. We found that to be a generative place to start because Coleman is not taking sort of a strong, I guess, deterministic stance on what agency is, what platforms are. The meaning of those terms comes at the point of contact, comes at the point of experimentation. And that's what we wanted our authors to be able to do, right? We wanted them to take their own case study, whether it's in literary studies or media studies or rhetoric, whether it's a mundane sort of infrastructural platform like Alexa or a rancorous, evil white nationalist platform like Gab or TikTok. And be able to see what agency means in those particular contexts with those particular bodies towards, the actions that they're attempting to do. So, to make a long story short, I feel like, we don't really stake a flag down on what agency must be all the time. And I think that's really the generative part of this project. And, I hope folks agree when they read the articles in conversation with each other.
I'd like to expand on what Reed said here because it's really important too. I think in the basing that we had, so many people have written about agency before us. This is not anything new. It's not really anything revolutionary. What we're doing is bringing in takes that might not have been seen otherwise or opening up positions because you can never really talk enough about this kind of thing because the thing is, platforms are changing all the time. In fact, just from the time that we have actually collected all these works, got the asks, got the reviews in and everything, they are now already new elements that I would have loved to have brought in. Rage bait, for example, which wasn't really something that was discussed when we were at this process, which brings in whole other questions about agency and platform. Australia just banned social media use for under 16s, and they're actually applying it, their enforcement there. So there are other questions there that wasn't necessarily at the time, in terms of that. And so, we're not saying that platforms are evil or bad necessarily. And we're not saying that agency is a free form. It's not like there is this political activism that's going to completely usurp and change social media. If that was the case, it already would have happened, or any platform for that case. We were saying that there are rooms for both. But what does that look like? And so I think that was important in terms of not necessarily staking a claim on either or, but pushing also the boundaries between these continued tensions of technological determinism and the power of human control over these platforms, because we're not denying the power of these platforms either. That's important for people to realize too. I think both Reed and I are probably more hopeful than what either of us probably even thought. I'm not sure. We'll see at the end of this, but I think we're more hopeful at least that there could be more control for agency that some people might even realize or take into consideration. But that's not denying, though, the harm that can still be done by platforms and the actual control of one's agency. And even straight up manipulation that can happen with many of these platforms.
And also different forms of agency, how agency can take different forms and how it can assert itself in unexpected ways. I'm very
Yes.
eager to see how that works out in the edition. One of the points I thought that you made that was incredibly interesting and valuable was when you characterized agency as flows of capacity that constitutively shape digital infrastructure and culture, as opposed to a possession, as opposed to even an exercise. So thinking about it as a flow seems to be incredibly generative and crucial to informing the approach to the definitions that emerge from the edition.
And I think the important part of the language of flow, when we kind of, it's often sort of seen as if it's flowing, if it's moving, if it's changing, that means it must be uncapturable and totally great all the time. And that's sometimes the case. But if you know anything about the economics of platforms, you know that flows of agency can also be subjected to capture. They can be monetized. Creative disruption, for example, is all based on constant momentum, move fast and break things. I think this characterization is, it's loaded, certainly. certainly. It's loaded with ideas that, in the context of platform infrastructure, literally where data is coming from, movement and expression. And that very movement and expression can be subject to the same type of capture that we tend to associate with more static, unchanging forms of agency as well. So not only is it just like more accurate to how platforms work, it's also, from my point of view, an important intervention that cultural studies can offer to the fields of platform studies, which unfortunately do tend to see a sort of, of course, a technological deterministic angle taking the forefront, in which the infrastructures are the ones in control and the agents are just the things that get moved around. They become these sort of like basic level specifications rather than being constitutive of the infrastructure itself. I think when you read the section, this really comes together in a plurality of different ways throughout the author's work. And I hope that scholars within cultural studies and outside of cultural studies can really take that to heart in terms of thinking about how to conceptualize agency on platforms and of platforms too.
It's the one thing I actually really enjoy about cultural studies is the study of power, because I think that really speaks to that flow and flexibility as well, because that's what then complicates technological determinism, right? Because it's the question of like, well, if it's going to be technological superiority, but who's actually pushing that? Because that's the interesting thing, is that technology evolution is not neutral. It's not like it's just happening itself, which is exactly though the argument that I believe technological determinism tries to make, is that it is part of this natural evolution and we are just kind of stuck in it. But at the same time, cultural studies comes in and says social, sociopolitical cultures is driven by several different factors of power. And the point is actually done really well by one of our authors, Medvedeva, who says the platform is only as powerful as the political environment allows it to be. And I love that, because that doesn't necessarily mean government. The political environment is constituted of a bunch of different factors, from corporations to users, players, subscribers,
People.
members, people, and of course, the government. And those, they always come into play. There are other factors that might come into you to then look at what happens, what kind of technological aspects becomes prioritized versus not. So there are lots of things to be said there about this flow. And I love that that kind of element brings that out to complicate that.
So let's talk a little bit about the selection of the authors.
I think when we were considering the inclusion, we had so many different abstracts that were of immensely high quality, and we couldn't just pick like the top 15, because we wanted to make sure that the special edition, for one, included a variety of platforms, but also included a variety of scholars coming at core questions in cultural studies from various disciplinary perspectives. We didn't want to just have, for example, 15 media studies scholars. Some of our priorities, for example, were A, we really didn't want most of the articles to focus on one social media platform, such as Facebook or Instagram. There's actually, for example, in my field, I conduct research on right-wing extremism on the internet. There is a robust amount of research that suggests certain platforms that have readily accessible academic API, such as RIP Twitter, and Reddit, are horrendously overrepresented in the scholarship. Why? Well, because they have transparent academic API. It is easy to conduct research on them. So we wanted to look at platforms that are harder to research, and in order to sort of correct for those tendencies that not only exist in my subfield, but in many others. So we selected a wide variety of articles. I think we, at most, we only had two at any given time that were examining the same platform. Another consideration that came to mind, it wasn't, we didn't use this to determine who we selected, but it was an important measure on the scale, was making sure there was a wide variety of different approaches being represented. We wanted to ensure that, especially approaches that have been marginalized in platform studies scholarship, were brought to the forefront in this special section. We definitely wanted to include feminist, critical queer, disability, and critical race perspectives that are often treated as marginal within platform studies. And so that was a major part of our selection criteria as well. Unfortunately, not all of the abstracts that we selected made it to the end, of course, like any other journal article. It goes through peer review when it is selected because we selected abstracts and then the authors had to write their articles and then it had to go through double-blind peer review like anyone else. So we didn't get to reflect all of the different approaches. For example, game studies and AI studies are some key platforms that we were not able to display in the final selection of articles, but our selection criteria tried to be as inclusive and representative of the field as possible while also doing justice to parts of the field that it has marginalized.
It was really strange being on this side of the table of this process. I'm used to just submitting stuff. And let me tell you, I would just like to send out a word of encouragement to anybody who applies. And I just want to let you know that you don't know the variety of reasons why your abstract didn't get selected. There's actually so much more that goes into it than just it wasn't good. And here's the thing, some people might argue, well, why isn't just merit-based? The problem goes back to the ask. What was the actual, our own abstract that we had to develop? What was the mission and goal, the objectives of the special edition, which is both in terms of lateral, since we're writing this full lateral for the CSA, there's a mission value and a direction that comes from that. And we have to be respectful of that, as well as then a mission value and objective that comes from the actual work that we were trying to develop from this. In looking at all of these abstracts, we oftentimes had to come back to, we have several good papers, but then having to weigh them, which one reflects best to these particular qualities. So it doesn't mean any of the papers weren't bad or good necessarily. You could have all, if I could, I would have accepted every single one. And that's not just because I'm a bleeding heart, but my students know I'm pretty much a bleeding heart. But the fact is that they were just so incredible. But at the same time, they also limits. Not everybody is going to sit and read 18 submitted essay special edition. Right? Even regular editions don't always cover that many types of articles, which is why they usually spread out. So if you do ever submit to a special edition and you don't get accepted, don't get down. See if you can get review. We do try to get, we tried the first round is very difficult to get review to everybody. Trying to get review to everyone for abstracts for almost 70 abstracts when we are also carrying both our full-time jobs, we didn't get to all of that. But we did try to get reviews to the second, third, fourth rounds that we had going through. But there's nothing wrong with if anybody had emailed me to ask why I didn't get accepted, absolutely, I'd take the time to write an email and let you know. So email them and see if they'll give you some feedback because you'd be surprised what that feedback might give you. And it might even help you improve for the next submission. And then try again. Find another home or another place for that piece of work. There is a place for it eventually. It's just a matter of trying to find it. That was really a very interesting learning experience for me on this side of things.
You gave me the idea to also speak to the point of view of people who might be looking to edit a special edition of a journal for their first time or an edited volume. Because I was a little daunted by the task at first, but now having gone through it, well, of course, we could say many practical things, but on the point that you were just talking about, it's okay to have an editorial vision. You don't just have to select the best names that are going to get the most traffic. You don't have to select the top 15 that you know are going to be really, really good. Giving a shot to graduate student authors who, may not have the most polished idea, but it fits perfectly, and you know that with care, it'll be really, really great. It's okay to go out of your disciplinary boundaries and invite folks to submit, are going to need to be tailored and framed a bit, but again, we'll just provide an interesting point of view. You don't have to be methodical and go one by one by one on a rubric. You're not grading undergraduates, you're producing a work of scholarship. I feel like, honestly, if I had sort of accepted that fact earlier on, I would have felt a lot less guilt when it came to sending a lot of emails about rejection and probably written the introduction a little easier too.
We had a bit of a crisis. I think at one point there was a crisis of, oh, we're doing poorly. Like we feel so bad about this. And then we both did have to come to the conclusion. We had many good mentors too, though, who we could turn to and realize, no, it's like Reed said, having that editorial vision is actually what gives your editorial structure and what gives it that necessary focus point to then actually include works that's going to make for an excellent rounded out point, even as they are a bunch of different works that might not even look related.
This edition raises such an impressive range of questions, and we have a few perhaps that respond to the questions that the edition raises. In what way has the meteoric rise of digital platforms affected the scope, scale, and impact of the research that you encountered?
There's at least three angles to tackle that question. And the one that comes to mind immediately for me is a methodological question, especially because the methods we're used to dealing with in cultural studies, unless you're like a digital humanities wizard, which I am not, deal with looking at something, usually long form text, really, really, really closely. Digital platforms, just by their very nature, produce more text, faster text, less meaningful text, and more functional text, text that's doing something. For example, an LLM prompt rather than a manuscript. How do we adjust the way that we read in order to attend to what text is doing on digital platforms, to attend to the different ways it's reflecting our subject positions, affecting our subject positions in so many different and really scary ways? I think in the addition, you see authors taking a wide variety of methodological approaches from Andre Brock's critical technocultural discourse analysis, which the Taylor and Childs piece uses to analyze hashtags on TikTok, to racial rhetorical criticism used to analyze the finer points of content moderation policy on a reactionary website, to the analysis of creepypasta, which is sort of like a pop literature, pop horror stories that's meant to be copied and pasted. So form is playing a bigger role than content in what that work, what that genre means and what it does. So you see people parlaying with methods that we are familiar with, but remixing them and retooling them to these radically different and interesting contexts. There's much more to be said to answer that question, but to me, I think that's the answer that cultural studies still has, a lot of work to formalize what we mean when we talk about digital methods.
What should the field of platform studies learn from cultural studies, and in particular from their research?
Well, platform studies does not have a political impetus in the way that cultural studies does, and I really think it should. I don't think there's a neutral way to study the platform because the platform is not neutral. The idea that there is a technological artifact that can be specified to each individual subject in their each individual way, be completely interoperable with the rest of the world so that it can be conveniently read by whoever owns the platform for whatever purpose that person may have, that can't be an apolitical definition. It's simply not possible in a world where power defines the relationship between all of those actors involved. I think there's a lot that platform studies can learn from cultural studies, and our authors bring out so many fine points of that question. But I think what unites so many of their answers is the imperative to politicize research and to not assume that when we're looking at something that wants to appear neutral, such as a platform, that in reality it actually is neutral. It almost never is. And being careful of those biases that platforms have, biases that algorithms have, to parlay with Ruha Benjamin, I think would dramatically strengthen platform studies.
Reid, your point about neutrality. As someone who is deeply skeptical of how platforms and power are integrated with each other, I sometimes view the illusion of neutrality emerging as an almost purposeful tactic. And so cultural studies and platform studies have a duty to recognize the strategy of political neutrality when we see political entities using these platforms and politicizing these platforms. And I'm thinking I'm going well beyond the big platforms such as X, which has been clearly politicized. I'm going well beyond Telegram, going well beyond Gab. I'm going and Truth, Truth Social. I'm moving into gaming platforms, for example, which have this illusion of neutrality, which itself ends up being caught up in politics of difference in really, really interesting and sometimes rather negative ways, rather destructive ways. So that sensibility of building in a logic of political recognition seems to be very critical in our moment right now.
That's an incredible point and such an important one too. It is a tactic. Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act dictates that platforms are basically have the right to, but undertake no duty to legislate content, to regulate content, because they are essentially neutral intermediaries. So the maintenance of that fantasy is, especially because most of these platforms are based in the United States, where 230 is relevant, is an important part of the big tech's legal defense to maintain a laissez-faire state of platform governance, which then gets exported to the rest of the world through things like malicious lawfare against the European Union and Latin America, among other odious tactics, avoiding GDPR compliance, malicious compliance. And you're right that it's not just the alt tech platforms. In fact, I think those are small potatoes when we're talking about the effect that the internet has had on radicalization among, you know, just the pervasive, terrible, sorry state of social life that we're all sort of dealing with. It's not just coming from these small platforms like Gab and Truth Social. Telegram is not a small platform, but that one either. WhatsApp and Facebook, these platforms that present themselves as being sort of free forums for deliberation, are in fact governed with very political strategy and tactics. Something that you can't say in your employer's face is something you can say in a WhatsApp group chat because those things are not regulated. And that itself is a political imperative that brings people towards different forms of antagonistic sociality almost as a habit. So you're absolutely right. And I think a platform studies that leans into the political work that platforms are already doing in the way that cultural studies has done for culture, for its entire existence, is necessary here and now.
What should the field of platform studies learn about the relationship between human agency and platforms?
And this is from Beth Coleman's The X-Reality Space. I know it might seem a little outdated in some, or it might seem simplistic to some people, but it's very difficult to capture the nuances and complexities of the whole thing, which is why it's such a interesting and good concept, because the X-Reality makes it sound like there's this really clean overlap, and that's not what it is. That's actually what is so increasingly interesting about platforms, is how we use the word ubiquity quite a lot when we talk about the penetration of digital life and platforms in our life. I mean, I'm going to be honest with you. I've started talking to Siri, not like in a friend way, but I've started using Siri in a way that I hadn't recently in several years because of some of the feature changes that have made life a little bit more useful and convenient. There's that keyword, right? And so it makes me feel like I have decided this for myself to use the more convenient route in terms of that. And so that's very interesting, pervasive nature of digital platforms and human agency, is that it's making us feel that we've really made the choice for this. So I don't want to be careful about getting into technological determinism because it makes it feel like technology has decided this for us and whatnot. But it's true, we do have choice. It's just though when it's so ubiquitous and so ingrained. Now, this is from the non-neutral choices, though, of other people. Individual actions that play into larger actions. When government systems like healthcare have so integrated digital systems to do the thing, how are you supposed to be able to actually separate yourself and choose a non-disconnected option when all of the ways of doing life, buying, selling, education, has been so integrated into these digital platforms that I feel like there's a complication there, or that continued tension about human agency and platforms?
The only thing I would add to what you've just said is I think that goes to show that whenever we're talking about agency, we need to be very precise about what we're discussing. Because when we use agency in a colloquial sense, we often think of like the sort of I think, therefore I am type of agency, where if it's coming from my brain, that means I know it's a true and honest expression of me. But can we really say that's the case when, for example, I feel myself getting frustrated when ChatGPT isn't exactly as responsive as it's promised for me, or when I see myself talking to Siri and I enjoy the feeling of convenience that that provides for me? There's obviously something a little bit more complicated going on there. But I wouldn't say it's not agency. So there's sort of like a hard agency that's always for me 100% of the time. And then there's like a more soft mediated type of agency. And really, maybe as someone who is kind of been influenced by Lacan for a long time and thinks the first one's not really possible, that aside, I'm much more interested in the second version of agency. The sense of agency is always mediated, agency as being part of infrastructure rather than just something that infrastructure moves around. And I think that being precise about what we're talking about when we invoke agency and making sure that the type of agency we're invoking is actually a thing that is real, that exists, and is not just a fantasy of agency that we tell ourselves in moments when we actually don't have any agency at all.
And that gets back to your very salient point about agency being defined as capacity and flow as opposed to possession and even exercise or imposition. Because I wonder sometimes about the unleashed agency of some of these platforms and how that underwrites a certain neurosis that some of us might have about things like AI, where it seems agentic on its own and not because of the way that it actually produces results. We're thinking about the imposition of, or the way in which it influences and inflects everyday life and our own relationships with information. So, an unleashed agency, an unleashed capacity, these flows don't have to necessarily be uncontrolled, but the fantasy of control over these flows that ends up being manifested when there's the realization or even the recognition that these flows are perhaps beyond our capacity to be able to control or be beyond the banks of our limitate of whatever we want to use to limit them. I think that ends up becoming an important facet of what we're discussing because then it reminds me a little bit of an immaterial version of Jane Bennett's Vibrant Matter, where she speaks about the way in which inanimate objects act upon us. So what if we think about these animated, inanimate, immaterial objects as having their own kind of capacity, their own sorts of flows that act upon us? And how can we subvert those flows? How can we expand capacity? How can we maneuver capacities? I'm thinking that that would be a way to understand differently the relationship between those who have power and ownership over those platforms and the user base.
Something that the Bot Police article really gets to your point, Dolores, is that when we feel like we've lost our agency, when we neurotically are sort of trying to find this nostalgic agency, that is to say, something we thought we had in the past, but we never actually did, that does tend to uniquely lend itself to this really revanchist sort of reactionary approach to objects. And in the Bot Police article, that manifests as this sort of, digital vigilantism and policing that's basing so much of its work on the human non-human binary, in so many problematic and also interesting ways. But we see that in so many other places, from people complaining about AI taking their jobs, all the way down to the grievances about content moderation that animate, for example, the takeover of Twitter and its transformation into X. So yeah, incredible point.
My article called The Bot Police dives deeply into this user-led platform governance of inauthenticity on Instagram. So the Bot Police are Instagram users who have authorized themselves to police and govern so-called inauthentic behavior on the platform in form of botting and porn bots. In my previous research, I conceptualized the practice of botting and defined it as repetitive posting and engaging as well as disengaging on social media platforms that can either be performed manually or automatically. Porn bots are defined as automated or semi-automated software agents that operate by using sexual solicitation to capture attention. So my research on botting and the Instagram Bot Police has shown that this relationship between agency and platforms is very complex. On one hand, we have the platform's interface, community guidelines, and governance strategies. They enable and shape user behavior and create power dynamics that favor certain types of engagement on the platform. For example, Instagram's algorithmic ranking systems reward botting behavior with visibility. This is one reason why users initially developed automated botting practices, because botting challenges these systems and influences the reach and visibility of an Instagram account. It represents an attempt for users to gain agency on the platform. But at the same time, this is a risky practice since the platform also sanctions automated engagement through, for example, deplatforming. This contradiction in Instagram's platform governance is comparable to their contradictory moderation of pornographic content. A study by the European nonprofit organization AI Forensics on pornographic ads revealed Meta's double standards in moderating pornographic visuals. The study found that they are removed when uploaded by a user, but on the other hand, promoted when uploaded as a paid advertisement. These double standards negatively affect human content creators more than they affect porn bots. On the other hand, we have users like the bot police who actively police and govern botting and other bot-related activities. The case of Instagram bot policing is particularly interesting as it highlights how users can take on limited roles as regulators and moderators of online behavior. But their possibilities through the Instagram interface to do that are very limited, namely to flagging and reporting content and comments to the platform. The bot police, for instance, prosecute botting activities and porn bots. Their actions can lead to the removal of accounts and also the restriction of user activity. But we have to say that this is not an institutionalized force, nor is there any code of conduct or training. The bot police operate at their own discretion. In my article, I also highlight the contradictions and double standards in Meta's platform governance that arise from its ambiguous concept of authenticity. Authentic behavior is seen as real or genuine, while inauthentic behavior is considered fake and is used to distinguish human-run accounts from automated ones. But however, this does not account for the hybrid and entangled nature of human and non-human agents in social media environments. Botting is a good example to demonstrate that it is not that easy. It's a common practice on Instagram to enhance visibility by challenging the platform's algorithmic ranking through high engagement rate. So as a user, I cannot differentiate whether a like, for instance, was performed because someone really liked or was interested in my content, or if someone just wanted to attract my attention. I also can't differentiate whether they pushed the heart button themselves or deployed a bot to do that. This example shows that the dichotomies between inauthentic and authentic, fake and real, and human and artificial are neither sustainable nor useful because the engagement on social media platforms inherently crosses these boundaries. This study on the bot police and my research on botting demonstrate that human and non-human agents are always already entangled in complex ways. So the concept of authenticity is counteracted by the medial operations of the platform. This highlights the interconnectedness of authenticity and artificiality on social media platforms and how the platform and users navigate this narrative of authenticity versus artificiality to achieve their own goals. The bot police's self-understanding as custodians of authenticity on Instagram reflects this reductive categorization of what they perceive as inauthentic and authentic behavior. However, this also highlights the power dynamics at play, as the bot police's actions against presumed botters and porn bots can be viewed as a form of mutual moderation and peer surveillance that reinforces the platform's governance strategies. The bot police position themselves above other users, risking the trapping of potentially real and authentic engagement, if one will say so, by threatening other users with public denunciation. They shifted the power balance hierarchically downward. This highlights another critical aspect of my research, the role of power asymmetries in shaping platform culture and agency. It manifests at different levels. Instagram's complex content moderation systems, for example, were developed in response to societal and political pressures. In 2016, it integrated independent fact-checking to combat the increasing spread of misinformation and disinformation in light of Donald Trump's first election as US president. After nearly 10 years, at the beginning of 2025, Meta announced the end of independent fact-checking, despite the ongoing prevalence of fake news, hate speech, and porn bots. The media coverage following this announcement links this decision to an effort to improve relations with the recently inaugurated President Trump, who's serving a second term. Power asymmetries in user-led bot policing on Instagram are shaped by the platform's governance strategies, the hierarchical dynamics among users and communities, and the broader economic and political pressures influencing platform policies.
I am actually very much a technophile. I am increasingly fascinated by AI. I am very interested in games and gaming. And yet, I inhabit this place of deep skepticism when it comes to some of these power relations that we see between people, platforms, and their creators.
It's interesting to see how different points of views and different points of views of different people having more, whether it's the more negative or did we say like maybe not negative, but skeptical points of views. I know that right now currently can be difficult to look at the time that we're in and where social media platforms are at. And even social media platforms, more than social media platforms, platforms in general, digital platforms, platformization are going through a difficult time with less users actually online than before. But there can be, and maybe I'm more of a utopianist still at heart or a positivist, even as much as I have been burned by so many of the things that I thought, the great revolutionary, the great disruptors. I'm looking at you, Netflix. I still hold this hope that there are still places of positivity. There are still places where we can use the very functions of these systems to do good. I think that's the interesting thing. Then I think some of our authors have these really interesting points as well.
My name is Nina Medvedeva. I am a postdoctoral fellow of women and gender studies at Hamilton College. I focus on the political object of the home, thinking through how it's regulated, how that regulation is contested, and how all of us are impacted and shaped by our relationship to the home. My current project, At Home in the Sharing Economy, focuses on Airbnb in particular, thinking through how the regulatory fights around Airbnb in Washington, D.C., Boston, and San Francisco teach us about how platforms reshape the home, as well as how the home might escape the platform's seemingly totalizing grasp. While it may be tempting to think of platforms as these incredibly powerful infrastructures that can escape government regulations and the best efforts by activists to contest them, what my work shows is that platforms are actually incredibly dependent on the political headwinds they find themselves in. In other words, as a platform is only as powerful as the political conditions allow it to be. But I also don't want to overstate just how fragile platforms are. I think what we find in these contests around platforms is this minefield of different types of agentic choices and intended and unintended effects that those choices then have. In my article, The Platform-Enabled Durability of Colonial Racial Capitalism in Washington, D.C.'s Wards 7 and 8, I think through these contradictory effects where people's choices on platforms might lead to what they want, but they also might lead to rather unexpected consequences as these choices are contextualized within the broader scales of the platform and the larger political economy that the platform is located in and reinforces. So what I mean by this is that a Black resident of Washington, D.C.'s Ward 8, who was an Airbnb host, might think that they're actually doing a really good thing, that they're bringing in money into neighborhoods that have been historically disinvested by the D.C. and federal governments, that they're fighting for a sense of place in Anacostia that pushes back against long-standing racist depictions of these places. But at the same time, given the location of Airbnb within a specific political economy, and given how Airbnb then uses the words of these hosts to justify its continued stay within cities without being regulated, those very positive things that Black hosts do might wind up actually contributing to gentrification in other parts of the city, or enforce processes of extraction that are actually deeply harmful to the ways of life that they hope to protect. And what I think this should do for us as scholars, as feminists, isn't necessarily produce a level of rage or a level of condemnation, even though that is one response that people have had. Instead, it should really prompt us to think about how the choices that we make, how we try to exercise agency, really can sometimes spin out of our control, and how the target of what we see as important feminist activism around housing should extend beyond individual actions to also encompass these broader scales of the city, the platform, and the structural world of racial capitalism that we're all located in. And doing this work isn't easy. It means thinking about the histories of a place and how certain platform economies didn't just drop out of the blue after the 2008 financial crash, but are actually due to long-standing historical patterns of racial capitalist dispossession in a given area. It also means paying attention to the really important ethnographic details of people's lives, thinking about how they conceive of their actions, thinking about the kind of discursive space that they operate in, how their activism responds to certain platform provocations while also maybe sometimes even playing into it by reinforcing the platform and its ability to continue to do business. And so it means really carefully paying attention to these multiple types of factors. And this is by no means a project that I think one researcher can take on. I've tried to do this across three cities, and it's really difficult to hold all of this in tandem. So thinking about this collaboratively, thinking about how we can draw on each other's work, proves to be very important. And even while we might maintain the sort of generosity about our interlocutors and the choices they make, as well as how they rebound in unexpected ways within a given political economy, I think it's important not to lose sight of what Brenna Bondar, drawing on Cedric Robinson, says here, the kind of constant object in all of this, which is the white supremacy that enables racial capitalist extraction to continue. That is our target. We should never lose sight of it, even as we attend to these multiple scales, as people make choices on platforms and we analyze their impacts. We should never lose sight that the object that we're analyzing is always within this socio-political economic field that we are trying to understand and hopefully change. I am recording this podcast in probably one of the darkest times that I've experienced in my life. Many things around us seem hopeless. Change seems incredibly difficult to attain. But what these platform fights have really taught me, and what thinking about platforms and agency has really helped me to understand, is that we do have the capacity to make change. It might not always look the way that we want it to. It might not always happen at the timescale that we want it to, but you can win fights that you engage in, even if there's more fights to come. And I hope that this kind of hopeful, positive message is what people draw from the article, even as it looks at an incredibly bleak phenomenon.
Do you have any final thoughts to share?
I think there are notes about where we can go in the future with the research. Many of our authors actually expand from here. And I think that's the place of this edition as well. We have placed ourselves within a certain place of time and space. And I think it's fair to ask, well, where does the research go from here now? And some of our authors have really approached that question, not just for cultural studies, but for platform studies, for internet studies, for anybody studies, in terms of where do we go from here? What could be next?
Hi, my name is Kelsey Cummings. I'm an assistant professor in communication studies at Christopher Newport University, and my research focuses on new media and identity and various different intersections of political power struggles as well as culture. So my paper looks at Twitch and is specifically interested in various different types of monetary transactions that happen on Twitch. Specifically because my research is very focused in affect and the histories of affect as discussed by folks like Berlant Ahmed. What I'm looking at here is essentially how emotional investment is translated into capital. So with Twitch, part of what interests me is the various different ways that capital exchanges happen. You have traditional subscriptions where a person will pay, say, $5 or so per month to a particular channel, in exchange for which they usually have custom emojis that they can use, as well as shoutouts, which they get oftentimes from the channel person in question. What this is essentially is a means by which Twitch as a platform tends to occlude as much as possible the capital nature of the platform. And this is very characteristic of social media, broadly speaking, and internet spaces writ large in the contemporary moment. This is why I think it's useful to look at Twitch as a particular example, because it is somewhat different from, for example, YouTube. YouTube has its own monetary policies, right? Something like Patreon also has its own separate sort of ways to frame the purchasing of subscriptions as being an emotional investment in a person or a form of supporting particular types of content. In the case of Twitch, because of its live nature, it instead shares a lot of different ways of sort of hiding what the nature of the capital exchange is. For example, what the person on the user side sees is they see, I'm donating X amount of money to this streamer who I feel really emotionally connected to. What they're not seeing is the percentage of that that goes directly to Twitch. And so given that, I'm really interested in thinking about intersections of these concepts of capital and affect in relation to agency and autonomy. Users are encouraged to perceive it as an interpersonal action rather than a purchase. Because of that, there's various different broader implications that we can think of. I'm specifically interested in how, moving forward, new media platforms will continue to try to make less clear the nature of capital exchanges and to instead make those capital exchanges perceived as having more to do with emotional investment. What I hope this article does is, A, give us a sense of how these shifts are occurring and are continuing to occur. For example, on a platform like TikTok, with live feature, the use of various different euphemisms to hide the exchange of money happens, for example, through things like flower crowns. You can buy a roaring lion, and the lion roaring is a literal just visual manifestation of that you just donated money to this streamer. In that way, right, we have this very clear coalescence of the hiding of the fact that money is being exchanged, and also the sense of literally reaching through the screen to touch the person that the viewer is assumed to be emotionally invested in. So, for example, they can put heart glasses on them, or they can make various other different types of animations emerge around their faces. So what you have here is a broad overlap that I think will very much continue to characterize the new media landscape moving forward. I'm also pointing out in this article to contribute to broader understandings of the overlap between these theoretical concepts of affect and capital exchange in the digital context specifically, and how this diverges and also continues pre-existing trends. Finally, I note in my conclusion that I think that future research should start to look more closely at the intersections of different types of capital exchange. So, for example, something that stood out to me quite a bit doing the research for this article was what I perceive as kind of the potential overlap between something like digital sex work and Twitch as a platform. There are expectations around the streamer's body and embodied experience that are oftentimes explicitly sexual, but even when they aren't explicitly sexual, they still have to do with this embodied exchange that's happening. Similarly, I think something like digital mutual aid often comes up here as well, and is something that I hope future research will continue to look into.
As someone who is admittedly quite skeptical of some of the notions of platforms, power, and agency, I'm incredibly excited to read this edition. I think it's going to be a vital contributor to the fields of both platform studies and cultural studies. And so I am eager to get it into my hands, very eager. So thank you both very much for the work that you've done to pull it together.
Oh, thank you very much. If you're interested in opportunities like this, I have to plug, as co-chair, the New Media and Digital Cultures Working Group of the Cultural Studies Association. We meet once or twice every single semester, obviously a little bit more as the conference comes together, and we do a whole lot more than just prepare for the conference. We share good news with each other. We share publication opportunities and job calls with each other. We're a tight-knit group of people, so we understand each other's interests, and just in general, it's a great group to get on with if you have any interest in new media and digital cultures. And if you don't have any interest in new media and digital cultures, any of the other working groups of the Cultural Studies Association are phenomenal intellectual communities, and so you should really reach out to their respective leadership and get involved.
Thank you again, Reed and Elaine, for joining us today and talking about the special edition. Be sure to check out the Lateral website at https://csalateral.org, not only for this special edition, but for all previous editions, including the regular fall and spring publications. We'd also like to thank the entire Positions editorial and production team, along with our co-producers, Mark Nunes and Elaine Venter, whose work makes these episodes possible. And we thank you, our audience, for your time and attention today. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to our podcast and join us for the next episode of Positions, where we will continue to engage with essential and pertinent topics in cultural studies.